Hello and welcome back to One Game at a Time, where we track the development of the game that we all know and love. And this week we're joined by, well, umpiring football royalty with Eleni Gloufsis joining us. Welcome to you, Eleni.
Thank you for having me.
And that buzz is in the air again, isn't it, gentlemen? Welcome back, Ryan Miller.
Thank you, boys. It's been a long summer, hasn't it? Has anyone watched any cricket? I watched a bit, and I'd probably rather not talk about it. But I'm so glad the season started again, and I get to get the pleasure of sitting in this tiny room with you two. Thank God we've got a special guest today, because I'm not sure I was ready for it. But Finny, how was your summer?
It was good. Didn't do a lot. Just a bit of housework, a bit of gigs, catching up with the family.
And you got a haircut, I said.
Got a haircut.
You did get a haircut.
Well, I went to a wedding on Saturday, and it said formal. So I thought, dinner suit, so definitely formal, shave, haircut. Wore the exact same dinner suit as the groom.
Is that right?
The only difference was the little flower that he had.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Trent Cotchin told you where to get your haircut? is that what happened? I like it. I don't know. Yeah, I think it looks nice.
I should say at this point that if you want to contact us on social media, you can find us on the Twitter at Origins of Footy or on Facebook, One Game at a Time, and hit us up with anything and everything. And now it's time for Mailbag. Finn, someone from Fitzroy's been pestering
us? I have Mick Coddle from Fitzroy. He's come with a question that not many people would think of, and hopefully Eleni knows the answer.
This is just like massive quiz. The whole thing.
When did umpires first start wearing white? Now we dug in, did some research to try to get it. Eleni, have you got any?
No,
you guys don't wear white anymore.
No, we don't. We didn't wear white for a long time though, and I just assumed we've worn white mostly because it's different from the teams.
Well. Yeah. That was the reason why George Coulthard wore white in 1880. So he started that because it was getting a little bit too difficult because they used to wear their kind of nice suits out there before 1880. So that was as simple as that, all white. And for all those traditionalists out there, when they do say, let's bring back the white, let's remember that they didn't wear white at the start. So to say that would be...
They just wear their normal clothes.
Just normal clothes.
Yeah.
Yes, and you wouldn't want to clash with that Hawthorne Robocop jumper that they've got. They wear at times. We're just a brief summary of our special guests today. She began umpiring in 2008 in the North Eastern Metro Junior Football Association in Adelaide. In 2013, became the first female umpire to officiate in a Sandful match. Received a 3-year AFL Female Pathway Scholarship in 2014. Moved to Melbourne in 2015, became the first female umpire in a VFL match and was added to the AFL umpires rookie list. And in 2017, she famously became the first female to umpire an AFL match. Very good evening and welcome to you, Eleni. Thank you very much for joining us.
Eleni, before you go on, is any of that wrong? Yeah. Because we do have a bit of a running joke going here. Well, people have been sending in messages via Twitter or Facebook highlighting normally Liam's mistakes. So did anything he say, was that incorrect at all?
Well, I did start umpiring in 2006.
Brilliant.
But that is one...
I feel like I've been set up.
Yeah. You are. Yeah.
But that's one that I think... I went to the SAFL in 2008, and so that's one that often is kind of miswritten down or misread. So
you're way too kind.
Started in the juniors in 2006 and then made my way through to SAFL in 2008.
It's been, I suppose, it must have been an epic change to your life since starting as the first female field umpire. Can you talk us through a little bit of how that change has affected you?
Yeah, look, I think moving to Melbourne in general has been the biggest change. And so obviously I grew up in Adelaide, my family, friends were there, my work at the time. Being offered this scholarship was just too good an opportunity to say no. So my partner Dylan and I moved to Melbourne at the start of 2015, and that was the start of all the changes. So moving from an SANFL umpiring group, you know, knowing the players, knowing, you know, my home and everything like that, to moving here, meeting a whole new VFL umpiring group, a whole new AFL umpiring group, a whole new work life, as that was the biggest change. From there, progressing through umpiring, VFL, finally into the pre-season and then into the AFL. So it's been a It felt like a long journey, but a really rewarding journey as well that has had many challenges along the way, but I wouldn't take it back for a second.
Oh, look, I suppose we have been lucky enough to be joined by an umpire in the past, slightly That's mediocre true. Compared to yourself.
I hope Michael doesn't mark.
Yeah, hello, Michael.
Yes.
Now, I suppose my question is more around elite level umpiring and the change from what you were doing in South Australia to now. What's been the most significant thing that you've noticed in terms of that, like, elite level?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that the state leagues are really improving and increasing their facilities and resources. And so, you know, every day, every year, the gap between, I guess, that sub-elite level at state league footy and the elite level is just getting closer and closer, particularly here in Victoria, where so many clubs have their own VFL affiliate teams. I think, you know, probably the main aspect is that true professionalism where, you know, coaching sessions are really discussion-based because everyone is at that level where they have an understanding of the rules application and have, for most of them, demonstrated that ability throughout many matches. You know, our list alone has many, many over 300 game umpires. So rather than it being a coaching session where there's more like a teacher-student relationship, it really is a discussion. And so that probably is an aspect that's very different from state league footy. But again, the training is hard, just like a state league footy, and you know we have to be our best to be have our skills and our fitness to equal, if not, I guess in some cases better some of the players so that we can keep up with the game for that whole, you know, 120, 200 minute game that there is these days.
So physically, as you just like, what are the demands? Like, what is expected of you?
So essentially, we have a few different time trials and standards to meet. So we have a 3K time trial. In which we have individualised standards now to suit everyone. The idea in that is that, you know, some people might have met that time easy, some people might have struggled to meet that time, and this way we're actually pushing everyone to be their best rather than just to meet this particular standard.
The bounce, does it stay or does it go?
Well, that's out of our hands, and Steve Hocking has made it pretty clear that he'd like it to be long-term. So essentially we went through a process last year where we were given the opportunity as well to have a discussion about the positives and negatives of the bounce, and you know I'm not for or against it. I love the bounce in the aspect of it's a traditional thing, you know, who doesn't love a grand final day when that first bounce is put down and it starts the game. Having said that, you know, I think 27 out of our 34 umpires have had injuries directly related to the bounce.
Is that right?
Absolutely, and that we found that statistic last year through the research, and so you know there are many positives and also many negatives to the bounce, but we just do what we're told to do, basically, and the bounce is staying, and so we'll all adjudicate to that.
Well, do you know when the bounce started?
No, that's a great question.
Because, again, going back to the traditionalists that are out there saying that it is a traditional thing, well, of course, it started as obviously a kick, other side of the kick to the other side, and then it was a throw-up in 1874. That was the famous rules that Henry Harrison changed when he was in charge. And the bounce didn't start until 1887.
You have firm opinions about the bounce.
I do. I love a good bounce. And as discussed on the previous episode, it wasn't until 05 when they brought in the silly 10-metre circle around the little 3-metre circle that it started to get difficult for umpires,
I guess. It goes to a lot of what we talk about as well with the tactics reshaping the rules. The rules reshaping the tactics, and then the umpire at the centre of all of it having to understand it, not only understanding the rules, but also to understand the little pamphlet.
The spirit of the laws. Oh, I love the spirit. Yeah. That's our favourite pamphlet.
What's your view on this? Because, like, coming from a different country and different sports growing up with, and doing a bit of officiating, myself, the idea that you would have so much grey area just is quite frightening, I imagine. How do you work through it? Do they sort of set you up with coaching sessions around how to interpret this pamphlet? How does it work?
Yeah, look, we do a lot of coaching sessions, and like the clubs, we go back to training in November, so we have opportunities throughout the whole pre-season and pre-season to kind of practice, look at vision. And so I think it's so important not only to watch the vision but to just practice making those decisions. And so the pre-season competition is not only important for the players but so important for us. I think we're lucky this year, it's the first year in all the years I can remember where there are no official rule changes. And so it was a great opportunity for us to try to really refine those different rules, so protected area, contact below the knees. Obviously, holding the ball and marking contests make up approximately 50% of our free kicks, and so they're ones that we continue to work on almost every week because, as you said, unfortunately there is grey areas there, and we need to be able to interpret those really small ones, whether they are a free kick or whether they're not, and we make hundreds of decisions in a game, whether it be a non-decision or a decision. And obviously you know, we're hoping to do our best and do the best thing for the game. And so, you know, we just try our best to get those right, practice them so that the outcome's right on the day.
One of the things on the Spirit of the Laws pamphlet, the 50-metre penalty, which has been obviously big talking point this week, first round one, entering that 10-metre circle. I mean, I don't know if you can tell us exactly what's been talked about, but how, you know, have you been asked to interpret that?
So the idea in bringing in the 10-metre protected area rather than the 5 was to allow that opportunity for that player actually to play on.
Yeah.
So really, when we think about the rule changes, it's either for player safety most of the time, or it's to hopefully enhance the game in some way. And so this aspect was brought in so that that player could run laterally and actually play on with some space to get that game moving and you know, high scoring, etc., like what we want. You know, obviously, on the weekend, on Thursday night in particular, we saw, you know, 5 instances where 50 metres were paid, and 3 of those were correct. And the really key thing for us is to have those key cues for us. So obviously we talk about things like being closer to 5. And so if they're closer to 5 metres, we're going to play a free kick. Whereas if they're closer to 10, you know, that little grey area, we're probably going to let them go. Obviously, if they have an impact, regardless, it's going to be a free kick.
Yep.
So closer to 5, no impact, still 50 metres. Closer to 10, no impact, play on or whatever it might be.
Going back on the coaching, Eleni, I just want to go back to 1901. Where Henry Crapp, who was the seven-time grand finalist, Mr. Miller.
Yeah,
seven-time grand finalist umpire.
Yeah. Yes, and he was credited in 1901 for actually explaining decisions to players. Are you guys encouraged to do that by your coaches?
Yeah, absolutely. If an opportunity arises, absolutely. You know, there's times in a game when, you know, as you know, the game is so fast, there's just no opportunity to do that. Mm. But if a player comes to speak to you, absolutely. You know, the better we can build relationships with the players, the better the outcome is for everyone. And really, these days with our mics, if we can explain a decision and have not only the player, but the commentator and the spectator understand the decision, the game is just going to be better. But most of the time when you get abuse and difference in understanding is when people don't actually understand the rule.
I did want to touch on protection. And because generally, it used to be the home team that had the responsibility of umpire safety, and now the AFL, it comes under their responsibility. And we have touched on it in previous episodes, the North Collingwood match in 1896.
Oh, the Bill Proudfoot.
Bill Proudfoot, yeah, where Wallace was mobbed. And there's another case with Bob Nunn in 61, where it went all the way to the Supreme Court. Rod Boffey, I think that's his how you pronounce it, was struck by a bottle, and the perpetrator was sentenced to 1 month imprisonment. Phil Carmen, of course, I guess quite spectacular.
The headbutting, yes.
Headbutt for 16 matches. Yeah. I guess all this is going towards is not only in the AFL, but where kind of before that in the lower levels. Have you always felt safe on and off the field as an umpire?
I think that's a really good question. And at the AFL level, you know, we see, not advertisements, but on the screen, it talks about penalties for misbehaviour and things like that. And it'd be very rare for that to happen in an AFL match now. I think it's, I wouldn't say common, by no means common, but it's more likely to happen at the lower levels, and probably not, I would hope, junior levels, but more amateur leagues and places where, you know, it's players who aren't necessarily elite or aren't going out there sometimes to play footy. They might be out there for social reasons or just as a way to kind of release some of their anger or whatever it might be through the week, that there are opportunities maybe for that to happen more likely. Now, I'm pretty lucky. I've only really experienced a couple of situations where I've felt uncomfortable. And that's just simply in a game where we've had a group of under-15s, we had to call for the game because it was basically all in brawl. But having said that, you know, I don't think I felt unsafe. It was just that that was the situation that was happening, and you just need to deal with it as best you can. And in that case, we just had to call the game off, which is what we did. So, you know, I think that we have ground marshals and we have lots of different people in place now at all levels to help support not only the umpire, but the players and the families and the coaches and everyone who go there to play the game of football they love, and to keep everyone safe.
When you sort of start looking at, I suppose, influential female officials from around the world, and you start searching first referee in this particular sport, and et cetera, you get some pretty incredible stories. Sian Massey-Ellis, from the UK, first English football officiator in 2010. She did Blackball v Sunderland, the Premier League. She's now got an MBE. Joy Neville from Rugby Union. She was actually a women's rugby player, played for Ireland, is now officiating games in the European Rugby Challenge Cup. And you can just keep going. The US is quite progressive with this stuff, maybe more so than a lot of places, although Australia's got individuals like Belinda Sleeman from the NRL, Casey Badger, who, you know, did NRL grand or finals games in 2017, although I think Belinda was ran the touch in like 2004, as far back as 2014. Maybe a sport you don't necessarily think is embracing,
yes.
You know, female officials. But yeah, you go back to the US, there's some like Violet Palmer, who has been involved in the NBA or is now retired, but like officiated in 1997. She grew up in Compton in the same street as the Williams sisters as well.
Right.
And then Sarah Thomas, who's in, you know, in the NFL, she started in 2009. The most amazing story I found, though, was another baseball one, actually, was Bernice Gera, I think you pronounce it, or Gera. Now, this was in 1967, where she just enrolled herself in her mid-30s in a Florida baseball school. And during this time, you know, it was pretty difficult to get involved in baseball at all as a female in the States. And she qualified, and then the MLB, Major League Baseball, changed the rules, and they said that umpires then had to be aged between 21 and 35. They had to be a minimum of 5'10". And the president of the MLB at the time said baseball stadiums were no place for females due to the foul language. But she took the court and then officiated in her first game in 1972. And she's the only female MLB umpire in 146-year history of that sport.
Well, then it lends itself to a seismic change in interpretations for gender equality, really, that we're fortunate enough to live through, I suppose. And you would have noticed that change enormously over the last few years, Eleni. Can you speak a bit to the change you've noticed with AFLW and all of the things around gender change in sport?
Yeah, look, I think there's some pretty clear examples, and AFLW is absolutely one of them. So, you know, I grew up playing football and I love footy. And, you know, if there was an AFLW, I probably would have been playing. Whether I made it to that level or not, I would have pursued playing rather than actually umpiring. And, you know, I think it's, you know, from when I started umpiring, you know, there was one girl out there in that group of boundary field and goals at my junior association. She was pretty quick to leave as well. And so it's interesting to look at that when now I go out and visit junior associations. I wouldn't say half yet, but there's a large majority of girls out there, which is just fantastic to see. And, you know, we have a look now at, obviously, the AFLW just providing role models, but not just that, but opportunities. And not just opportunities to play, but to umpire, to coach. You know, you can be involved now in any aspect of football, which beforehand was just not even a reality for most girls. And so I think it's just fantastic, those girls who are in their 30s, who continue to play footy and finally have the opportunity to now play at an elite level. And they've kind of hung on, probably just the opportunity to just play because they loved it. And now there's finally a place for them to actually play on the big stage, which is just fantastic. You know, in terms of umpiring, we still see various grounds, you know, AFL and VFL level without female change rooms in the umpires' change rooms. You know, Chelsea and I battle with the uniforms not fitting and things like this. And that's like we've had from, you know, junior level. But, you know, it's really about you loving the game, being passionate about the game. And if you're not passionate, those things probably would have bothered you and you would have left pretty early on. But, you know, for people like Chelsea Roffey, Sally Bound at the moment now in Perth, and myself, you know, it's clear that we are so passionate about the game that nothing was going to stand in our way to be the best that we could be.
I did a bit of a brief history on female umpires, and I've kind of traced it back to three women that have allowed you and people like Chelsea, Rose O'Day, kind of to get to that elite level. So Kathy Fisher, she qualified as a junior umpire, and she made it known that she wanted to be an elite umpire in 1978. And then I guess another example, and nothing occurred, but it was just, oh geez, do females want to be at the elite level? And then Rowena also, she took it to the Equal Opportunities Board hearing in 81 because she wanted to be a VFL reserve grade umpire. Now, this didn't even get to the board. It was kind of settled outside where they offered her a coaching position. So she didn't get there. And Sharon Elgar, I think is how you say it, she got put on the AFL development squad in 1990. She was a VAFA umpire. Didn't didn't progress into the AFL, but was the first woman actually to join the AFL union. And I guess my question is, what have been the biggest challenges at the elite level? And does gender play a role?
It's a really interesting question. And I spoke with Tony Caldwell, who's an NBA, Australian NBA referee. She's been umpiring for 11 years, which is another amazing story that we just don't hear enough about. And, you know, she talked about the opportunities that she probably wasn't given because she was a female, but also the opportunity she was given because she was a female. And I feel this completely relates to me as well. You know, I had a really long stint in the SNFL reserves, so like the second grade for the SNFL, and I umpired over 50-odd games, which is probably quite unusual for an umpire who is and ends up progressing to kind of umpire that many games before their first opportunity to umpire at a state league level. And, you know, at the time, it didn't bother me, but I kind of thought, you know, I think I'm ready, you know, what's happening? And, you know, Shane Harris, my coach at the time, probably held me back, but to make sure that I was completely ready. And when I walked out for my first game in 2013, I was 100% ready. And I can't thank him enough now for making sure I was completely ready before he kind of threw me in there, because it ended up being a little bit bigger than I had expected in terms of the media attention. And so, you know, to get to that point and not be ready, it could have ruined my whole career. And realistically, that's something that, you know, at the time it was challenging and I wanted to keep improving and keep progressing. But now when I look back on it, I couldn't be more thankful for that someone stepping at the right time to say, we need you to just do this a little bit more before we know that you're ready. Having said that, you know, Wayne Campbell, who was the director of the AFL Umpire Association at the time, introduced this female pathway. And, you know, I'd like to think that if through my progression I would have made it to the AFL, but by now, probably not. You know, it's so, you think about in the 22, 23 million people we have in Australia now, I'm one of 34 who gets the opportunity to potentially umpire AFL every week. Yeah. And, you know, realistically, especially living interstate from Victoria, we get looked at not as many times probably as the Victorian umpires. And there are lots of pathways now where there are talent identification programs. And so, you know, the top few will get looked at more often, yes. But we still don't have the opportunity to see the coaching that they would in the AFL. And so it's hard to get into the AFL as a interstate umpire from Victoria. And to have that opportunity to come to Melbourne, be part of this list and just have that progression that I had the opportunity to umpire, you know, that wouldn't have happened if I wasn't a female. And so, as I said, hopefully I would have been on the list. But at this point in time, potentially not.
I've got a question about the Brownlow medal card. So you have to fill in 3, 2, 1, and the three of you negotiate that in some sort of way. Have you ever got to actually fill it out?
Yeah. So as the emergency umpire, often I'll do the writing and things like that. But yes, even as in my five games, you know, you often fill it out. Someone has to do it. So the key thing is to make sure the three is actually the lowest line. So 3, 2, 1.
Oh, right.
So ooh. The key thing is to make sure that you remember which order it has to be.
You can see that going wrong, can't you?
Absolutely.
And are there disputes?
We'd explain a few years as well.
Do you sit around the table and have a go at each other about like interpretations of it?
Yeah, look, sometimes there'll be those standout players who, you know, straight away, yep, this is best on ground, this is second best, and then sometimes the one you might have a bit of a discussion about. But there'll be other times when, you know, we don't receive statistics or anything like that. So it's based on what we think of the game and how we see it. And, you know, someone might say, oh, this person had, you know, crack a game and this person says something else. And absolutely, it comes down to those three plus the emergency umpire having that discussion and coming to a conclusion that that is the right outcome for the game, because we totally understand it's a significant part of the game. You know, the Brownlow is significant in terms of, you know, who wins that end of the year and how people poll. And so we really want to get it right. Yeah. Absolutely want to get it right.
I can't believe, like, we did an episode on this and we're looking at, you know, the way best and fairest or, you know, MVP is, you know, given across sports across the world. I can't find one where officials have that level of responsibility.
The armour guard thing is
that's right.
It's locked to
the big fella locked to his arm. It's incredible, really, what comes with your role.
I suppose it's easy to give Tom Mitchell 3 votes on Saturday evening with 54 possessions.
Yeah, that's not too difficult, I imagine.
Yeah.
Going on, you don't receive stats, are you not allowed to look at stats? Or is it just you do it right after the game and you're not even thinking of that?
So within the umpiring room, as soon as we enter, we give in our mobile phone or any kind of device that can basically contact the outside world. And the main reason of that is integrity. So integrity in terms of, you know, potential, you know, match fixing and things like this that, you know, being an umpire in that professional environment, people would just, they wouldn't even think of it now because we're at such a high level that you'd completely be throwing away your career. Having said that, so we need to hand in our phone. So we have no kind of contact with anyone apart from those people until the end of the game, post the votes are done. So we only get our phones back, our iPad or whatever it might be, once the game's completely finished and the votes are done and everything. So we have no access to any of the statistics or anything.
Is it in your head when you're running around? Like I've got to just keep my awareness around who's doing 25. What here. Like, yeah.
Great goal. That was
amazing. Are you trained for that? They say, oh, just watch in this way?
Well, I think the really, I guess, lucky thing is that we do that throughout our whole career. So yeah, okay. from the juniors, you start out going out there and thinking, I need to pick three best players here. And you're not consciously thinking, oh, that was a good kick, or this person's playing okay, because you've got so many things to think about. But at AFL level, the really good thing is we're really realistically expected to know every individual's names. So it's not just about, oh, who was that number, or, you know, that guy with long hair, you know who it is.
Yeah.
And so you're able to kind of say, well, you know, even though I know he's a defender, I know he played his role really well today because he was playing on so-and-so and whatever else. So we have a pretty good understanding of the players. You know, we spend a lot of time, you know, pre-game and sometimes in coaching, talking about matchups, you know, key things players do that might be helpful for us to know. We might talk to umpires from the previous week about certain things that happen, particularly matchups these days with lots of tagging, lots of holds, stoppages. We need to know that stuff. We need to be across it. So because of our understanding and knowledge of the players, you know, we generally know, you know, who's probably kicked a few goals because we know who that player is, or we know who's had a few touches, or who's been exceptional in the way they've actually helped their team to achieve what they've achieved.
There's a situation with Razor Ray the other day where the non-officiating umpire came over the top, reversed his decision. Unfortunately for him, he was just finished explaining why his decision had integrity. And the other one came over the top and he's looked over to sort of this and here, but couldn't because the non-officiating umpire came in. The non-officiating umpire has sovereignty. Is that correct in those cases?
Look, the person who has, I guess, the belief that they're correct and think they've seen. And realistically, we're always going to err on the side of the player protection.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in the case where Troy was on the side where what he would have seen Bryce Gibbs dump him completely.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're lucky in the aspect that, you know, Bryce Gibbs actually did the absolutely perfect thing we want him to do in that situation and realistically kind of cradled him to the ground.
Yeah.
And having said that, Ray was in a great position. And generally we would say that if we can see that the officiating umpire is in the perfect position, we'd let them go. But it's those situations when, you know, we are a team and we can't afford to miss dangerous tackles because they are so important in our game. And our primary role is player safety.
Mm-hmm.
And there is times when, as the officiating umpire, you don't see those dangerous tackles because of your angle, or you don't quite see how that action was. And so, you know, it's not a problem at all that Troy paid it, because what he saw was a dangerous tackle from the action. And we would realistically rather pay a decision for player safety than to not pay it. And so, albeit in that situation, it was incorrect. And Ray, the way he explained it, was correct.
Yeah.
But player safety is paramount for us. And so if that's what the decision was, Ray was always going to step back and say, no worries, let's pay that dangerous tackle.
I think the that support that you get and the coaching that you talk about is significant, because I think we need to remember it. Before 82, there was no umpiring development run by the BFL. And it happened because in round 19 of 1981, I believe, all 32 umpires walked off the job. And I believe that was on the Thursday.
Not halfway through the second quarter.
No, not halfway through the second quarter. About pay and conditions and things like, you know, we don't get, you know, proper change rooms, protection pay, all those things. And that then the next year the VFL were forced to have an umpire in development academy of such. I guess the AFL now is doing great things to encourage umpires. What's the next step? Where does it go from here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, you know, Steve Hocking has brought in a few different things. He obviously has supported us in getting a full-time high-performance coach. And so basically the last few years what we've had is that Hayden, who's in the head of umpiring in terms of field umpiring, we've got three other full-time coaches. And then obviously we've got our head of umpiring. But then head of boundary and head of goal umpiring are still part-time roles. And so realistically, you know, I'd hope that in the future those types of roles became a full-time employment, so that they have the opportunity, because these types of umpires are state-based. So we've got boundary umpires in South Australia, Western Australia, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria. The opportunity to actually travel to different states more regularly, to actually confirm and ensure that everyone's on the same page with different rules and training is the same and things like that. And so, you know, albeit giving up my life in Adelaide was really challenging, it's so good to be in Melbourne with 34 umpires, to have those discussions, to see the coaching firsthand, to go through the same training, and just to have, you know, individual discussions with specific umpires, but also just to hear different discussions. And so I think that, you know, by having now a full-time high-performance coach, that's just another step in the direction of, you know, are we, albeit we train only twice a week, are we performing what we can do outside of the Adelaide level, because we now have someone holding us accountable or checking in and giving us different methods, different ways, different strategies to be at our best, whether that be recovery or, you know, fitness or coaching or whatever it might be. There's more resources available to us. And I think, you know, going forward, that's probably one thing that we just need to hope that does continue, is that we continue to get more resources that not only help us as elite umpires, but also in places to help the community umpires to visit and promote and encourage and form those different pathways and networks.
Look, we just got to thank you from the bottom of our hearts, Eleni, for coming in to provide some that real, you know, expertise and professionalism, something that we certainly don't have really anywhere in our lives, apart from Ryan sometimes on the golf course.
You couldn't help yourself, could you?
Well, I've got to get
that
it in.
That was season one, and you brought it back, and now it's going to be a joke for the rest of the episodes, and we're going to have words, me and you, I think. It's been a fantastic insight, and I think it really has. Thank you so much. Just for the fact that there's somebody else here, just rather than me and just the two brothers. It's quite much.
Thank you to you, Ryan.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you, Finn.
Thank you, Liam.
Thank you, Eleni.
Thank you for having me.
And don't get ahead of yourself, and take it one game at a time.